Well, it's very good to be with you today and to share with you in this meeting. I've enjoyed being with you a lot and getting acquainted with this congregation. There are many good things about what's going on here, and I appreciate it very much. I think the way in which you're integrating a Spanish-speaking group with an English-speaking group is interesting, and that's really very important. Obviously, as we move toward the future, we're going to need to be able to do more and more of that because people of America are becoming more diverse, and we need to find ways of being reaching out and sharing with people who have different backgrounds. And so what you're doing here, I think, is very important in showing how that can be done in a good way, and I appreciate that a lot. I also appreciate all the good food that we've had to eat here after our services, and many things that have happened. I appreciate the hospitality of many of you, and so it's been very good to be here. We're studying today from Revelation chapter 20. So if you have your Bibles, you can open to Revelation chapter 20. And we're talking about the thousand-year reign. And let's put that in the context of the chart we've been using that I think all of you have probably seen already. We had the idea here of the rapture, the signs of the end, and then the rapture, and the tribulation period in which there would be the rebuilding of the Jewish temple, and then a war over Israel, climaxing with the Battle of Armageddon. And in the midst of that terrible carnage in Israel, according to this theory, Jesus returns, and he puts down the war and establishes a kingdom that will last for 1,000 years. And during that time, there will be those who were raptured who will be here in the reign. The Old Testament good people will be raised to enter that reign, and those who were converted during the tribulation will enter that reign. And it will last for 1,000 years, and all those people will reach the age of 1,000 years as they live here during this period of time. And it won't be perfect according to this theory, but it will be a good and blessed time because Jesus will be the ruler of the world. And then at the end of that time will come a period of where the bad dead will be raised and the final judgment of Revelation chapter 20. And then people will go away into heaven and hell. And that's what this theory teaches. Now, we've been talking about various elements of that during our series. And today we're focusing on the thousand-year reign period. Does Revelation 20 teach that there'll be a thousand-year reign of Christ on earth? That's what we're going to study tonight, today, and see if that is the meaning of this passage. So we look now at Revelation chapter 20. As we studied earlier, the story of Revelation is the message that Christ wants to get to his people, particularly those in the seven churches of Asia and other churches of that time, so that they can be strong to withstand the persecution that's about to come on them. And by the time we come to the end of chapter 16, which we studied before, he has brought down the persecuting power of the Roman Empire and the cult of emperor worship. Chapters 17 through 19 are a sort of a retelling of that same story. And chapter 19 also ends with the beast and false prophet being cast into the lake of fire. So chapter 16 and chapter 19 both end with the destruction of the persecutor. So 17 through 19 is a retelling of some of that same story. And when we come to the end of the 19th chapter, the Roman Empire, the persecuting power, the beast, and his ally, the false prophet or second beast, are cast into the lake of fire. And that's where chapter 19 ends. Now the question is, what happens after that? And that's what we're going to study in chapter 20. So chapter 20 says after that will come what is called a period of 1,000 years. 1,000 years. And two things, according to the first six verses of chapter 20, will happen during that thousand-year period. The first one tells what will happen to Satan. That was a question asked in the class earlier, and here we come to answer that question. What will happen to Satan? Satan is going to be bound. These first three verses say that I saw an angel coming down, and he had in his hand a chain and the key to the abyss. And he opens the abyss, and he binds up Satan with the chain, the dragon, and throws him into the abyss, and he will be bound for 1,000 years so that he can deceive the nations no more until the 1,000 years is finished. Satan is going to be bound for this period of 1,000 years. Now, what does that mean, Satan is bound? You know, some people, I think, make the mistake of thinking that every time that Satan is said to be bound, it means the same thing. So let me ask you this question. Don't answer this too quickly. Has Satan always been bound? Let me change the wording. Has Satan always been limited? Has God ever allowed Satan to do anything he wanted to? Story of Job, was Satan limited in the story of Job? Could he do anything he wanted to Job? He was limited. God always has the upper hand. Satan has never been equal with God. He's always subordinate to God. So Satan's always been limited in some way. And other passages talk about limiting of Satan. In Matthew chapter 12, verse 29, Jesus says, I couldn't cast out demons unless I first had bound the head demon, bound the strong man, okay? So Christ bound Satan, in a sense, limited Satan when he cast out demons. Also in Luke chapter 10, verse 17, when the 70 return and they've done their work, Jesus said, I saw Satan falling. The preaching of the gospel that was, of the story that was coming, the kingdom was coming, was a binding of Satan. Or in Colossians 2:15 says that the cross despoiled the principalities and powers. When Christ died on the cross, he put some limits on Satan, didn't he? Because he gave us the opportunity of forgiveness of sins. And with the opportunity of forgiveness of sins, I have a way of escaping Satan. Because now I'm not on his side anymore. I'm on Jesus' side. And I can do that because of the cross. Or Revelation chapter 20, verse 9, there's war in heaven and Satan is cast out so that Jesus can take his place in heaven. So the Bible speaks of Satan being limited or bound in different ways in different times for different reasons. So in what way is he bound here? It says in chapter 20, verses 1 through 3, Satan is bound so that he can deceive the nations no more. What had Satan been doing during the early part of the book of Revelation? Deceiving the nations. He had used the Roman Empire, a conglomerate of nations, and he had deceived them into thinking that it would be a good thing to persecute God's people. And so he has been deceiving the nations. That's the story of the book of Revelation, is Satan's deceiving the nations. And finally, God brings the coalition of nations down to defeat the Roman Empire, the beast. And so that group is gone. And God says, I'm not going to let Satan ever do again what he did here in using a worldwide coalition of nations to try to persecute the church out of existence. I let him try that once. I will not let him do it again. He can no longer deceive the nations like he's been doing during the storyline of this book. He can't do it anymore for a period of 1,000 years. I feel something coming on here. Ah, there it is. That's what it says. It says 1,000 years. What does it mean? Doesn't mean literally 1,000 years any more than dragon is a literal dragon or a beast is a literal beast. The numbers in Revelation are also figurative. So we shouldn't think of this as a period of exactly 1,000 years, but it's a relatively long period in terms of various time periods given in the book of Revelation, 10 days, 3.5 years, 1,260 days, things like that. So for a relatively long period, God says, Satan is going to be bound so that he cannot deceive the nations anymore. I let him do that once. I will not let him do that again. Satan will be bound in that sense. Doesn't mean he can't tempt people. Doesn't mean he can't do things that will deceive us. But it means he can't do again what he did in this book to use a coalition of nations worldwide to try to persecute the church out of existence. And that's never happened again. There's never been that kind of persecution of the church. Some here, some there, some here, but never on the scale that the Roman Empire did it. I won't let him do that again. So that's the meaning of the binding for 1,000 years. Not all bindings of Satan are the same, and he's bound so he cannot do what he did earlier, deceive a worldwide group of nations to try to persecute the church, and he has kept that promise. Now let's look at the next three verses. Not only does the 1,000 years contain the binding of Satan, but there's another situation that lasts for 1,000 years. Let's see what that is. 1,000-year reigning. Verses 4 through 6 say something like this. I saw the souls of those beheaded for the testimony of Jesus and who had not worshipped the beast. And they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. Now we want to study this passage very carefully and see what it says. Let me read those words again and think now what this might mean. I saw the souls of those beheaded for their testimony and who did not worship the beast. And they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. Okay. Now let's examine that a little bit. I want to ask you four questions about the 1,000-year reign. There are four questions to ask that will tell us what this means. The first question is, who reigns with Jesus? Who? Who is reigning with him? Well, it says the souls of those beheaded for their testimony and who did not worship the beast. When did we begin to see people who had been the souls of those beheaded, of those who confessed Jesus, who held the testimony of Jesus? Back in chapter 6, verse 9, I saw the souls of those who were beheaded and held the testimony of Jesus. And they ask the question that we talked about in the class today. How long, O Master, holy and true, do you not judge and avenge our blood on them that are on the earth? Never given a white robe and told to wait. And then in chapter 7, we saw those again, where they're wearing the white robes and serving before God, and they're living a happy life because their persecution is over and they're now in heaven with God. And then we saw them again in chapter 14, and others had joined them by this time. And now they're in heaven and they follow the Lamb wherever he goes and they sing the song that nobody can sing but them. And we saw them in chapter 19, riding on white horses, following Christ as he goes to quell and conquer and take victory over the beast and the false prophet and throw them into the lake of fire. And so now here are those same ones who have been beheaded for their testimony and who did not worship the beast. And what are they doing? They are reigning with Christ for 1,000 years. So the who question is, who is said to reign with Christ? Those who have been beheaded for their testimony and did not worship the beast. Doesn't say everybody who's ever lived. Doesn't say all the Christians who've ever lived. It says those who were beheaded and because they would not worship the beast. Those persecuted during this time of persecution being described in this book, they are the ones who are said to live and reign with Christ for 1,000 years. So, that's the who question. Who reigns with Christ? It's the martyrs. The souls of the martyrs, not bodies. They're not in bodily form, they're souls. They're souls. They've died. They've been beheaded. And they're in a they're in a status in, that we would call souls, and those souls live and reign with Christ for 1,000 years. Now the second question is why? Why do they reign? In your Bible, does chapter 20 come right after chapter 19? Is that the way your Bible is? What happened at the end of chapter 19? The enemy was defeated, thrown into the lake of fire. Final, total, complete defeat for the beast, the Roman Empire, and the cult of emperor worship. They're defeated. What do you do when your enemy is defeated? What's the thing you do? What do you, somebody say the word. What do? You celebrate, don't you? So what is this? This is a celebration of those who have been beheaded because their enemy has been defeated. And so we see here the defeat happening in the end of chapter 19. And so it's a celebration. The rain symbolizes their victory over the persecutor. And so we have here a celebration. So the who question is, those who are who've been beheaded because they wouldn't worship the beast, been persecuted and killed by him. Now the beast has gone down to defeat, and it's time for them to celebrate. And that celebration is pictured in the storyline as a 1,000-year reign. 1,000-year reign. That's how the celebration story is told. 1,000-year reign with Jesus. Well, if you were living in Ephesus or Smyrna or Thyatira or Pergamum or Sardis or Laodicea, and you got this letter, and it says there's going to be persecution, and a lot of people are going to lose their lives, but be faithful, wouldn't it be an encouragement to you to know, if I go through this, and I'm faithful, and even if I'm persecuted and killed, I know what lies in store for me. It's a 1,000-year reign with Jesus. Won't that be wonderful? So this is written to encourage those who are about to undergo the terrible persecution. Well, let's now ask the third question. Where do they reign? Who is it? Souls of the martyrs who've been persecuted, didn't worship the beast. Why? To celebrate their victory. And the third question is, well, where does this reign take place? Well, these souls have been in heaven since chapter 6, verse 9, where they were seen as souls under the altar. Chapter 7, they're serving God in heaven. Chapter 14, they're in Mount Zion, the spiritual Mount Zion, in heaven. Chapter 15, they're in heaven, singing the songs of Moses and the Lamb. Chapter 19, they're in spirit form, riding with Christ as he wins the victory over the enemy. And so the souls have been in heaven all this time, so where would you expect them to be now? And remember, it says souls, not bodies. It's souls. And so this would be a heavenly reign. Souls have been in heaven, and thrones have been in heaven. The only throne mentioned in the Bible, in the book of Revelation, that is not in heaven is the throne of the beast. All the other thrones mentioned are in the spirit realm. That's what I mean by heaven, in the spirit realm. And then Jesus has been in heaven. In chapter 5, we see a lamb looking as if he had been slain, approaching the throne of God. That lamb, of course, is Jesus. And so throughout the book of Revelation, Jesus has been in that heavenly scene. So if that's where souls have been and thrones have been and where Jesus has been, where do you expect this reign is taking place? Well, of course, this is a heavenly reign. And it doesn't, in those three verses, 4 through 6, it never says a thing about this being on earth. And if we understand the storyline that's going on, these people have died, they've been beheaded, they've been killed, they've been martyred, and here they are in a spirit realm, living and reigning with Christ for 1,000 years. Now, the reign then is heaven, in heaven. And there's no mention of reign on earth, and the souls would be in heaven, and that's where the reign takes place. Now let me insert here, this is not the postponed kingdom of Christ. Some people think that Revelation 20, the 1,000-year reign, represents the postponed kingdom of Christ, that when he came the first time, he didn't get to have a kingdom because the Jews turned him down, and so now he is coming back to have that reign. But if you'll notice in 1 Corinthians chapter, in John chapter 6, verse 15, you'll notice that it says that the people, the Jewish people, tried to take him by force and make him king. If he had come to be that kind of king, then he would have accepted their offer. But he did not come to be an earthly physical king. And the kingdom that he came to establish was a spiritual kingdom, and he did. Colossians 1:13 talks about Christians who are been translated into the kingdom of God. So he created a kingdom, and the church is it. The people who are in the church are in his kingdom. And so this reign is not the postponed kingdom of Christ on earth. It's a spirit reign with those who are persecuted. Now the fourth question is, when do they reign? When do they reign? Well, this reign begins when the Roman Empire, the persecuting power, goes down to defeat, the end of chapter 19. That was about 475 AD when Rome finally was defeated. And so during this period, after Rome falls, Satan is bound and can't deceive the nations. And this reign is going to last from that defeat until the end of time, except for the little time, which we'll talk about in a moment. And so here is that reign of Christ that is going to go from the time the enemy is defeated, about 475 AD, until the end of time. That's the 1,000-year period. It's as long as it needs to be. 1,000 years doesn't mean literally 1,000 years. It's as long as it needs to be to fill that time period. And it's before the return of Christ and the bodily resurrection. You'll notice in these verses, it says this is the first resurrection. That doesn't mean a bodily resurrection. That's talking about the revival of God's people during this 1,000-year reign. They were been downtrodden, and now they're revived like a resurrection. The real resurrection takes place after this time is over. When Jesus returns, according to 1 Corinthians 15, verses 24 through 26, when he returns, he will return the kingdom back to God. He doesn't return to start a kingdom. He comes to end his reign. So he will end his reign when he returns and give the kingdom back to God. So this is not something that will happen after Christ's return. It is a reign that happens before Christ's return. So he's going to reign. He's reigning with these martyrs now in their victory celebration, and will reign with them almost until he returns. So that's the answer to the when question. So there's only one bodily resurrection, and that's on the last day. And the first resurrection here expresses symbolically the renewal of the martyrs. This 1,000-year reign then is symbolic of the victory of the martyrs over Rome, the persecutor, and not a 1,000-year reign on earth. Not a 1,000-year reign on earth. Christ said, "My kingdom is not of this world," and he never intends to come back and set up some kind of earthly king. A kingdom. He is reigning now as king, and when he returns, he will end his reign, according to 1 Corinthians 15, 24 through 26. Now, that's what we know about the 1,000-year reign. Let's tag on to the end of that a little bit, the rest of the book of Revelation. We'll take just a moment, and we'll go through the rest of the book. After this 1,000 years, the book goes on to the chapter 20 goes on to the little time. There's a 1,000-year reigning and binding, and we've talked about that. Now there's a little time, verses 7 through 10, in which Satan is loosed, and Satan gathers his forces to attack the church again. But this time, before he has any success, God strikes him, and he is cast into the lake of fire, where he'll be tormented day and night forever and ever. We don't know very much about the little time except to say that God has Satan in this pit, the abyss, And he wants him over here in the lake of fire. That's his eternal abode. And so when he takes him out of the pit, Satan wants to do what he did before. And he tries to gather his forces and surround the church. And God says, not this time. And he sends him into the lake of fire. So Satan hasn't changed. He didn't. The 1,000-year binding didn't cause him to change his intentions any. He still would like to fight the church. But before he can do any damage, God strikes him and sends him into the lake of fire. Then we come to chapter 20, verse 11 through 15, a time of judgment. I saw a great white throne, and him that sat upon it, from whose face the heaven and the earth fled away. And I saw the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne. Everybody who's ever lived is going to be gathered before the throne of God for this final judgment. And every man was judged according to his works. All the dead are there, and the judgment is based on the works, the books of deeds. How many of you want to have everything you've ever thought or said or done projected on that great video screen in the sky before everybody who ever lived? Does that sound like a good plan? Would you like to have that happen for you? I don't believe I want that, but that's what's going to happen. Everybody's there, this great judgment day, everybody will be judged according to their works, except those whose names are written in the book of life. Oh, what happens if your name is written in the book of life? Then you have a different outcome. The book of life is a very interesting expression. It occurs throughout the Bible. In Exodus chapter 32, verse 33, whoever has sinned against me, him will I blot out of my book. Way back in Exodus, God has a book in which he has written the names of those who are his, and if they keep on doing what he wants them to do, their names stay in the book, and if not, he blots them out. Psalm 69:28, let them be blotted out of the book of life, David says, of his enemies. Luke 10:20, Jesus says to his disciples, rejoice that your names are written in heaven. Philippians 4:3, whose names are in the book of life, Paul says about Christians. Hebrews 12:23, the church of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven. Revelation 3:5, to Christians, Jesus says, I will in no wise blot his name out of the book of life. Revelation 13:8, whose name has not been written in the book of life of the Lamb. It's the Lamb's book of life. Revelation 17:8, whose name has not been written in the book of life. Revelation 21:27, but only they that are written in the Lamb's book of life will go into heaven. God has kept throughout the centuries a list of those who are his. I believe there was a song written about that. Let's see. How does that song go? Something about names being written. What is that? Oh, I know what it is. If you don't do what God says, you're going to be written out of the book of life. God's making a list. He's checking it twice. He's going to find out who's naughty. I don't guess that's in the Bible, is it? But it's about what he says, isn't it? God's got a list. And he keeps a list of those who are his. And those who are Christians, who have used Christ's blood to cleanse their sins, their names are written in the book of life. And so in that great judgment day, if your name is written in the book of life, all your sins are forgiven. And so you don't have any stuff up on the video screen in the sky that's bad. Oh, that's gone. That's pretty good, isn't it? God will take away all of your sins. And so everybody someday will stand before God in judgment. And those who are wicked will go into the lake of fire, which is a way of symbolically describing a terrible place. Not literally burning fire, but a place that's torment and a place that's painful and a place where all is bad. So it's symbolically described to us as a lake of fire. But those written in the book of life have a different destiny. And that different destiny is described in chapters 21 and 22. What happens to those who are written in the book of life? Revelation 21:1, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And it goes on to say that the dwelling of God is with men. He will be their God. And there won't be any more death or mourning or crying or pain anymore. Well, that sounds wonderful, doesn't it? Perfect place to live. And that city that comes down is described in various ways in the book of Revelation. It's described as a perfect cube. And it has 12 foundations of precious stones. And it has 12 gates, 3 on each side, that are made of pearl. It has a wall of jasper, red, 210 feet high around it. 12 gates of pearl that are always open. And streets of pure gold. And God and Christ are the light. So there's no need for a sun. And there's no temple there because we will see God face to face. And a river of life flows from the throne of God. And on each side of the river are tree of life trees. Not just one, but a whole row of tree of life trees. And each one bears 12 fruits, a different one every month. That's what it says. What does it mean? This is a symbolic representation to give us a message. There's a word that describes heaven, one word that describes heaven. Perfect. It is perfect in every way. Let me tell you 4 ways that this description tells us that heaven is perfect. Heaven will offer perfect protection. A perfect cube, you can't get in it, you can't penetrate it, a high wall. All of these things suggest protection. These early Christians were not protected, they were vulnerable, persecuted, but they're going to a place where nobody can get them anymore, perfect protection. It's a place of perfect provisions. Walk on streets of gold, eat of the tree of life, drink of the water of life. Those suggest to us perfect provisions. All we need will be fully supplied. It'll be a place of perfect fellowship. All the good who've ever lived will be there, and none of the bad who've ever lived will be there. It'll be a place of perfect fellowship. Will we know each other in heaven? Oh, I believe we will. Oh, yes, I believe we will. David said when his son died, a little 1-year-old son, he shall not come to me, but I shall go to him. Moses and Elijah appeared with Jesus years after they died. They were still Moses and Elijah. You don't lose your identity when you die. And so, yes, I believe we will know each other in heaven. There's a lot about life in heaven I don't know. A lot of things will happen that I don't understand. I just know it'll be a wonderful place. It'll be a place of perfect fellowship. And finally, it'll be a place of perfect joy. No tears in heaven, no sorrow, no pain. There will be no doctors in heaven. Oh, a good Christian doctor can go there, but he won't get to practice medicine anymore. Why? Nobody ever gets sick. There'll be no undertakers in heaven. Oh, they may have been good Christian undertakers, and they go to heaven, but they can't practice undertaking anymore, can they? Nobody dies. There'll be no barbers in heaven. Because there's no parting there. Well, forget that. But there is a place that is perfect in every way. Perfect in every way. Well, the book of Revelation closes with some wonderful words. Whosoever will, let him come. Anybody who will submit to Jesus can have this wonderful thing happen to them. They can go to this wonderful place if they will come to Jesus. And so we have the choice of making a decision about where we will spend eternity. You know, it's amazing to me that God has allowed me, a sinner, the opportunity to live forever with Him, because He sent Jesus to forgive my sins. And because of that, I can have confidence that someday I'll be with Him in heaven. And so we long for that place. Let me close with a story that I like to tell. Some of you may have seen this on the video that you've seen, but I like to tell it wherever I get the chance. Some of you have heard of Dr. James Dobson, who writes books about parenting and has a radio program and all that. And don't necessarily agree with everything he says, but he had an experience that I want to tell you about. When he was headquartered in California, he brought out to be on his program a great basketball player, one who had very outstanding. And so this outstanding man, whose name was Pete Maravich, came out to be with him. And so they thought they'd go out and play a little basketball, and they went out to play basketball, and they were standing at the three-point line kind of shooting baskets, and suddenly Pete Maravich just keeled over backwards. And they called for the paramedics, and Pete Maravich dies in Dr. Dobson's arms. One of America's premier athletes, dead at age 40. Well, that caused the Dobson family to think a lot about life and death, and they decided that they would suggest to each other a way in which they would say, "I want to be with you in heaven." Each member of the family says, "I want to be with the other family members in heaven." And they did it by holding their hands out like this and saying, "Be there, be there." That meant, "I want to be in heaven with you." Wasn't long after that until Dr. Dobson had a heart attack, and he was in the hospital in intensive care. Tubes down his throat, he couldn't speak, hooked up to the machines. His son, about 20 years old, comes in. What do they want to say to each other? That's how they communicated to each other. They gave each other the thumbs up. Father to son, "I hope I get well, but if not, I want to see you in heaven. Son to father, dad, I sure hope you get okay. But if not, I want to be with you in heaven." That's the spirit we all ought to have, isn't it? We want to be with each other in heaven. Now that's become our family motto. All my kids, my grandkids know all this, and that's what we say to each other. My wife has made these cross-stitch plaques that go in each family's home. "Be there." When we had our 50th anniversary, our children gave us a golden "Be there" to display in our house. They gave me a license tag. You know what my license tag says? "Be there." My favorite picture is my 10 grandkids giving me "Be there." Be there. Now I'm going to say "Be there" to you and hold out my hand, and I want you to give it back to me good and strong and solid like you mean it. All right, here we go. "Be there." Come on, do it again. "Be there." Once again, louder. "Be there." Now turn to each other and those beside you and say, "Be there. Be there. Be there." Now let me see if I've got this straight. After this is over, you're going to go tell somebody, "You know, when the craziest preacher come, all I remember is..." And that's okay. If you remember, that'll be all right. Because the most important thing is we want to be in heaven together. Now, I hope you can say right now, "I'm ready to say that I believe I'll be there. If Jesus came right now, I believe I'd be there because I have obeyed Him. I have been baptized into Christ, and I've lived like He wants me to live." So if that's your condition, that's wonderful. If, on the other hand, you say, "You know, I don't believe I can say be there to somebody, because I don't believe that's where I'm headed right now. I haven't been baptized into Christ, or I've done that and I haven't been faithful to him. If you're not so you can share with us the belief that you will go to heaven because of your obedience to Christ and acceptance of his grace, then you ought to come and let us help you to be ready to be there. So if you need to do that, come while we stand and sing.